This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. On the show this week, a Cape Bretoner who was a star mathematics student and went on to become one of Canada's most recognized scientists gets a call from Health Canada to lead a team in the fight against COVID-19. The deputy mayor wants to have your ear on the possibility of renaming a beach on the north side. Arlene McMullen says she's opening the floor to hear opinions on an idea brought up in the council chambers stemming from a national tragedy. Before we wrap up with the deputy mayor, she'll also talk about some good news for dog owners on the north side. Also on the show this week, the municipality acknowledges an event that happened about three quarters of a century ago. It's been described as the start of the atomic age. CBRM Councillor James Edwards will explain in a moment. These stories are coming up on Dialogue. District 2 Councillor and Deputy Mayor Arlene McMullen was commended by her fellow elected officials for proposing a new name for Indian Beach in North Sydney. It's not a new idea, but she says since the recent discoveries of unmarked graves near former residential schools in Canada, more and more people are contacting her, suggesting it's time for a more appropriate name.
Originally, it was never meant to be derogatory. Actually, I think it was more out of respect and acknowledgement of, you know, Indigenous people that use the area is the history that I've been aware of. And over time, I mean, if you talk to people now, some people find that it is more of a derogative term now, using, you know, Indian Beach as the name. Other people think it's just fine. You know, so the intent originally with that name was really to show respect. It wasn't meant to be anything else. But I think recently, obviously, with everything going on in the Indigenous communities and across Canada, and, you know, the shock and awe that we're all feeling as Canadians with that, you know, the terrible past and the loss of all those children, that people are just taking a moment to realize and empathize and just really wanting to make sure that everyone in the community feels included and that we're inclusive. And that's the message that has been brought to me.
So it's been a few years that people have been speaking to you in your constituency, but like you say, that discussion picked up with the discovery of the unmarked graves near residential schools across the country. Is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I would say I was elected in 2016, so possibly a handful of times, maybe over the last 4 years or so, that the name did come up. And there was a lot of work done to the beach a few years back, and the idea of the name change then had come about, and different discussions were had, and, you know, there was discussions with an Indigenous groups at the time, and it wasn't a concern of them. And to be clear, right now, the idea of changing Indian Beach, that's not being brought forward by the Indigenous community. It's being brought forward by the residents as, you know, something they want to try and be proactive and rectify, and because they're having a difficult time with the name now, too. So, yeah, I think that pretty much sums that up.
Can you talk about some of those conversations you're having with the constituents there on the north side? And is it true that they maybe feel a little bit uncomfortable and embarrassed with the name? And like you said, this is not coming from Indigenous communities or Indigenous leaders.
No, the majority of people that reached out, like in the last couple of weeks, I'd say I had about a dozen formal comments, like formal requests to look into the possible name change of the beach. And the most common reason for it is people are embarrassed saying the name. And I'm not saying like people in general or the majority of, you know, residents of CBRM, but the people that reached out to me, when they talk about the beach, it's such a lovely area, but they're very uncomfortable prior to everything that has gone on in the last few weeks. They have been very uncomfortable saying the name, you know, because they're trying to be respectful and inclusive, and it seems to go against that for some. So that's really the main reason. And another reason is, a few people have brought forward, which I think is absolutely fantastic, is in the idea of reconciliation, education is a big part of that, and to understand the history. And by going through the idea of changing the name or even looking at the possibility of it, it really brings forward that education piece and the possible, you know, the ability to put out that historical background and learn more about the Indigenous people and the history they had here. So, there's a lot of positives coming out of the idea.
For that educational aspect, if council does go ahead with the name changing, would you welcome people to be on a committee or part of an organization to help with the educational part of it and the historical significance of Mi'kmaq people in the area?
Absolutely welcome anything. Like right now, CBRM doesn't have a policy for name changing, like for parks and things like that. So we don't really have anything to follow. So the motion that was brought to council was to consider, and you'll hear me say a possible name change, because the whole idea behind bringing this is I want collaboration and consultation with everyone, with all groups. You know, I want to make sure that we include the Indigenous communities, that we include our residents, that we include staff, that we include, you know, and that these conversations happen. Because in the end, you know, if the majority of people or if it's not a concern, perhaps the name won't change. I'm pretty sure it probably will, but I can't be that. So this is really the choice of the residents and all residents in the CBRM. So I'm really looking forward to see what the process brings, because right now the staff is going to come back with an issue paper and really describe their ideas of possible routes we could take to get this started. But community input is really the main part that I will be pushing for. So I'm really hoping that the education piece turns out to be a very large part of this, regardless of what the name ends up being.
When this item was brought up on the agenda at the recent council meeting, it seemed to you had suggested that it was an idea that you do support, and council seemed on board with you as well. In fact, I think most, if not all, commended you for bringing the issue to the table.
Absolutely, absolutely, because they looked at it as more, council doesn't always have the opportunity to be proactive. A lot of time, the majority of the time, we're reacting to situations or reacting to a complaint, and this is different. This is not, like I mentioned before, at the request of any Indigenous group or person, but the actual residents in the area for the most part and community groups. And it's something almost to be proud of, that the community is looking to be inclusive and the community just wants to do better. So council really embraced that, and they were very commendable to me, but I do want to put it out there that it's not me. I'm simply the voice of the people that brought it forward. You know, it's our residents and our community that we really should be commending for stepping up and acknowledging that, hey, this could be an issue. Could we be more respectful? Is there an education piece that we can do here? Let's acknowledge that, hey, we know this, you know, let's bring this forward and see what we can do as, you know, a community.
Can we talk about that procedure involved in the municipal affairs there, Arlene, for a second, when it comes to name changing? Council did agree to move forward with a so-called issue paper. Exactly what is an issue paper and what function will it serve for this issue?
We usually, most motions do ask for an issue paper. And what that is staff will take it back. You know, the people that are, you know, the planning department, I guess, in this case, and they'll do the research and they'll do the background. And because this is, you know, I'm a counselor, but by all means, I am certainly not a spokesperson for, you know, the finance department, parks and recreation. I rely on staff for their knowledge. And in this case is no different. So the staff involved would take that back and they would do their research and they'd come back and they'd give us a background on what perhaps, I don't know, I'm just kind of grabbing things here now, but maybe in past circumstances, this is how we do a name change, or, you know, this is, we'll have a committee, or they usually come back with options. Whereas, okay, well, if you want to start with public participation, let's say, well, maybe we'll form a committee, or maybe we'll put out a survey, or maybe, you know, so they just really get it started, and then council decides the direction we want to go. So they'll do the background, they'll do the research, they'll bring it to us, and then we'll make a decision on how we're going to move forward each step as we go.
Have you received any suggestions on what a new name for the beach should be? Of course, there's a process involved there and a few chapters to go through, but are there any ideas that are surfacing now?
The only one that I've heard, and apparently before Indian Beach, and again, Indian Beach, since I was a child, that's all I've ever known it by. So, but prior to that, it was referred to, I believe, as North Bar Beach. And I'm told by a local historian that North Sydney is actually part of the reason of being referred to North Sydney is because of North Bar, and there's a connection there that, again, an education piece, because I personally am not fully familiar with. So that name has been tossed around a little. And then there has been other options that people are looking at. Okay, let's reach out to the Indigenous community. It was called Indian Beach. If we want to change it, perhaps they can suggest a name. So people are really open to a lot of ideas right now. So I'm interested to see the direction it's going to take.
For municipal procedure and a new name for Indian Beach, would people outside of your constituency be able to offer suggestions?
Oh, my goodness. That's the hope, you know, that it's a CBRM initiative for, you know, the Indian Beach is located on the north side, but it is something that is used by residents from all over. It's a gorgeous picnic area, playground, beach. It's one of the greatest places to grab sea glass. So, and you know, again, consultation with our Indigenous communities, and they're not on the north side. They're in other parts of the CBRM. So yeah, my hope is that it includes the input from residents all throughout. Now, we'll see how that goes, but that is what I'd like to see.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. You earlier talked about, we were supposed to talk about a new dog park for North Sydney, but Indian Beach was on the council agenda for a recent meeting, and we didn't want to lose that opportunity to talk to you about that. If you still have time, there are some dog lovers on the north side excited about giving their companions a place to socialize with other dogs. Can you take it from there, please?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we are in the process of putting in a dog park, a fenced-in off-leash dog park. In North Sydney, up, if you're familiar, I don't know, when you come off the highway there to the Amira Centre area, there's the Carmen Young walking track, there's a skateboard track. Well, the place that the dog park will be located is just up in behind both those areas. So they'll actually share the parking lot of the area and just walk, you know, a path up to the dog area itself. We did have a dog park put in. This was a motion of council. This resulted out of 2019, I think I brought it forward. And we did have a dog park installed in Sydney Mines off Crescent Street, in the Pitt Street ball field area there, actually, even though you'd access it through Crescent Street, it's kind of in that clump of recreation. But when it was done, it wasn't really, we made an error. And what we did was we located the park too close to residential areas, and there was a few complaints, and rightfully so. You know, everyone's not a dog lover. Everyone, you know, there is noise associated. So, and because of that, we had to then relocate. And it took us a little while to find the right spot and to make sure that, you know, we're not going to disrupt anybody. And so that the whole purpose is for this to be a good news story. So we really don't want to make, you know, we really want to make sure that it's embraced by the majority of the community, to say the least. So it took us a little time to figure out where might be a good spot, but I think we found one now. So that's where we are with that.
So this idea was, it's not a new idea. Like you say, it's a transition from the work that was being done in Sydney Mines, but inevitably a dog park was coming for the north side area.
Yeah, well, as a result of that motion of council, yes, it was coming, because even prior to that, when I got into council, anybody, and you know, especially since COVID now, holy moly, but dogs are a really big part of pets in general, and dogs are a really big part of a lot of people's lives. And on the north side in particular, pets, even on a leash, were not allowed on any public municipal property. It was written right into the bylaw. And we didn't offer any off-leash space. We didn't offer any leash-on space. We literally offered no alternative for anybody to take their dog anywhere else other than, you know, up the sidewalk, and even that was frowned upon. So we made a few changes with the public spaces that dogs on leashes are permitted in certain areas. And then we went farther with the dog park because Sydney had the opportunity. Like Rotary Park is an off-leash dog park, and New Waterford had an off-leash dog park. So Central and East were covered. But the north side in general, like whether it's Sydney Mines, Bredor, George's River, like there was nothing. So it was my goal to make sure that opportunity was there for all residents in each of the areas, north, central, and east.
What would some of the rules be for the pet owners and their dogs in a park like that? I would imagine it would take a dog to get used to the idea if they haven't been to a dog park before. So maybe a little bit of time between the owner and the dog before they step into the park. Is that something you would encourage?
Yeah, well, the onus is on the pet owners. And, you know, I'm a dog owner myself. I'm lucky. I have space where they run free on their own. So, you know, I'm not so reliant on necessarily a closed-in park. But the onus is on the dog owners. If you have a very aggressive dog, you're not permitted to take a dog there. If you have a dog in heat, a female dog in heat, they wouldn't be permitted to be at the park. If you have a puppy under a certain age due to different, you know, diseases and colds, you know, canine-wise, I suppose, they're too young to be there. So, and there's rules. I mean, you have to walk from your car to the dog park, so they have to have their animal on a leash until they get there. They have to pick up after the dog immediately. They're not to permit their dog to dig holes. If there's, you know, really, if you're really a responsible pet owner, they're not so much rules, it's common sense. But there is definitely rules put in place. But I'm really hopeful that we're not going to have any issues, because our other dog parks really don't seem to. And it's not just socializing the dogs, it's socializing people. And I use the example of, you know, if you live alone, and especially during COVID, you live alone, you have your pet, that's everything. So if you have the opportunity to go somewhere, maybe you're not very mobile, maybe you're a senior citizen, maybe where you can let your dog run and socialize with other dogs as you sit there and socialize with other people, you know, have your coffee, have your bottle of water. It's a reason to go outside, and it is a great social event for both the pets and the owners.
Yeah, when you see the dogs at some of the other dog parks that you mentioned, it's a lot of fun to see how excited that they actually get, where they're, you know, mixing with their, I guess, with their own kind, for a lack of a better word. But it's very entertaining for the pet owners, too, to see their dogs so happy.
Absolutely. You know, dogs are very smart, and it's like watching children play. They don't care how big you are, how small you are, how, you know, how much you weigh, what color you are. They just go in and they have fun. And it's a way to really run your dog so that they have a good sleep. And even if you don't own a dog, if anybody's listening that doesn't own a dog and aren't really sure, if you're driving by a dog park, pull over and just have a look, and you will see how much fun not only the animals are having, but the owners enjoying watching them.
Yeah, they don't ask for much, huh? Just to get out and roam around once in a while and play with other dogs. But other than that, they're pretty good companions.
Well, that's it. And on top of that, I mean, we're in a municipality that is pretty cash-strapped. That's not a surprise to anybody. But dog park, like this dog park, is very, very affordable for the reason we already own the property that we're putting it on. The fencing was a small investment, but we're reusing the fencing that was actually put up down in Sydney Mines last year. So there's no additional cost there. You put in your garbage can. Like, it's a very easy, low-hanging recreational activity that can be enjoyed and not break the bank. So I'm really looking forward to it, and I have been inundated with others that are anxiously waiting for the day it opens.
So when do you think the park will be ready?
I don't think it'll be too long. I don't have an opening date as of yet. The clearing, because they did have to clear some brush and some trees in the area, so that has already started. So once that clearing is done and the fence is up and the garbage cans are put in place, and the pathway's all laid out, it really shouldn't take too long. I'm expecting in the next couple of weeks, if not sooner.
Okay, so on that note, we'd like to say thanks to Deputy Mayor Arlene McMullen speaking to us about the possible renaming of Indian Beach in North Sydney. And not far from there, after you and your dog take a stroll on the beach, maybe you'll be able to head up to a new dog park soon. And you said that's up by the Amaris Centre after you come off the highway, and that's up by the grocery stores there, correct?
Yes, just at the top of the hill there, when you enter into North Sydney onto King Street. If you turn into the Amaris Centre parking lot, you'll see just on the left, there's another parking lot, and you'll see Carmen Young Walking Track, which is also a little soccer field, and you'll see a skateboarding park, and there's going to be a path right up the centre of those, and tucked in behind the tree line is where you'll see this park. And can I also add,
sure,
if anybody's interested or has any questions or comments in regard, concerns, if you go on to the CBRM Facebook page or the CBRM website, there is a link, and you can click on that, and that will direct you to some quick information, frequently asked questions, as well as an opportunity for you to put in any concerns or questions you may have.
Do you have a name in mind for the dog park?
No, I really don't. And I'm not sure if that's something that even would be required to be named per se, right? So we really don't have, I never really put any thought into it, to tell you the truth. That's the first time I was asked that question. I just refer to it right now when people, the North Side Dog Park, you know, it's not North Sydney, it's not Sydney Mines, you know, we're the North, and it's something recreational for all of us to enjoy.
Okay, got it. Is there anything you'd like to add, Arlene?
No, I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time. Great to talk to you, and good luck with the renaming of the beach and with the new dog park.
Thank you, and thank you for the time for reaching out.
Staying with Regional Council for a moment, another item on the agenda for a recent virtual meeting, a proclamation for Hiroshima Memorial Day. Here's Councillor James Edwards.
This August 6, 2021 marks the 76th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, followed 3 days later by the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. And whereas hundreds of thousands of civilians died in these attacks, and tens of thousands more have suffered and are suffering from the wounds, radiation sickness, and multi-generational genetic disorders triggered by the explosions. And whereas today's 14,000 nuclear weapons possessed by 9 states are equal in their destructive power to more than 1 million Hiroshimas. As in 2013, the Cape Breton Regional Municipality joined the Global Mayors for Peace Coalition based in Hiroshima, pledged to work for a nuclear weapon-free world. And whereas in 2017, 122 states adopted the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, also known as the Ban Treaty.
Canada hasn't signed the Ban Treaty yet, mentioned by Councillor Edwards, but for a bit more background, here's a short clip from the show Sunday Today, and they aired this segment during last year's 75th anniversary.
A United States Army Air Force B-29 dropped a 10,000-pound plutonium bomb nicknamed Fat Man over the city of Nagasaki, Japan, 3 days after Hiroshima. Japan surrendered less than a week later, bringing to an end World War II. The decision by President Harry Truman to use the atomic bomb has been debated ever since. So how does it look 3/4 of a century later, especially from the vantage point of someone who was there on the ground? Harry Smith has our Sunday Spotlight.
July 16, 1945. Of that first successful detonation of a nuclear weapon in New Mexico, Robert Oppenheimer, the head of the Los Alamos Laboratory, reacted this way.
Line from the Hindu scripture, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Less than a month later, the Enola Gay drops an A-bomb above Hiroshima. It explodes 2,000 feet above the earth. Tens of thousands die instantly.
"We shall completely destroy Japan's power to make war."
3 days later, Nagasaki is the target, with a similar result. American Howard Kakita, then 7 years old, had been standing on the roof at his grandparents' home in Hiroshima. His grandmother insisted he come down.
"If we stayed on that roof when the bomb exploded, we would have been burnt to a crisp. This is after the A-bomb."
Howard says one way to understand the horror of that day is to look at the numbers of American lives lost thus far to COVID-19.
"That took 8 months. That one primitive bomb in Hiroshima killed the same number of people in a very fraction of a second."
Yet as soon as the Soviet Union had a nuclear weapon, the arms race was on. Baby boomers were taught to do this.
What was sort of ludicrous, as you will recall, we all had drills to hide under our desks.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman negotiated nuclear control issues with both North Korea and Iran.
"Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the only times in history that nuclear weapons have been used. What did the world learn from that?"
"The world learned that nuclear weapons should only be a deterrence, not a war-fighting weapon. Now it appears that many countries are considering that there might come a time when they would use a nuclear weapon."
While the U.S. and Russian stockpiles are shadows of their former selves, North Korea is believed to have 20 or more nukes, and Iran looks to be inching its way toward a nuclear weapon.
Do you think there's enough tension in the world, in certain places, that someone would make a purposefully wrong decision and use a nuclear weapon?
I hope not, Harry. I really hope not. I don't think actually there's any country that really wants a nuclear war, but I think through inadvertence or accident, you could see an escalation that might take us there.
It's important, I think, that we understand the misery and terror and death that it caused. If we were to be able to put all those stories together and present it to the world with the knowledge of the mistakes, I think that'll be a wonderful task to do.
Harry Smith, New York.
Edward said during the meeting that a poll taken in April showed that 75% of Canadians are in favor of signing the ban treaty, and Council proclaims August 6th of this year as Hiroshima Memorial Day in the CBRM, a day to remember the devastation of Hiroshima in 1945 and to renew the commitment of ensuring the freedom from the threat posed by nuclear weapons here and everywhere. Dr. Art MacDonald is an astrophysicist and a Cape Bretoner at heart. Born in Sydney, he's known for solving the neutrino problem. That involves an elite understanding of the energy of the sun. For that, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. But the night he accepted the prize in Sweden, he had a very down-to-earth challenge. That was making sure he didn't get tripped up with the crowned princess, as they were both dressed to the nines, descending into a gala with some of the brightest minds on the planet.
Well, it actually was when we were coming into the main dinner, I was coming down a very long staircase. The way in which it works is that as it turns out, the physics prize winners are the first ones to come into the very large dinner room, 1,500 people having dinner together, and so the physics prize winners enter with the king and queen, with this, it goes alphabetical, so my colleague from Japan was with the queen, and the king was with his wife, and in my case, I was with the crown princess, and my wife with her husband. But the crown princess was about 6 months pregnant or so at that point, and she had this long gown, and I was coming into the ceremony, and so I think I didn't look up once. I was being very, very careful not to step on that gown as we came down the set of, 50 stairs or so into the ceremony. So sometimes you get placed in situations that you would not choose, but I managed not to trip her or myself, and actually it turned out to be a very, very major event on the week in Stockholm.
So you must have had a sigh of relief after that and maybe enjoyed yourself a little bit more after that. It's quite the entrance.
Yes, it was a lot more pleasant. It turned out that I was actually seated between two of the princesses, both of whom turned out to be wonderful conversationalists, and it was really a pleasure to meet them and talk with them. And of course, that's their business, is talking to other people, so I shouldn't have been surprised.
So that's quite a journey, studying high school physics in Cape Breton and receiving the Nobel Prize in Physics in Sweden. That was about 6 years ago. Is it naive to think of that as perhaps a sports analogy? You know, maybe a kid playing hockey one day winning the Stanley Cup, or an actor winning an Oscar. Is that something that you had chased, or did it just happen all of a sudden?
Oh, it's certainly not something that I had chased. On the other hand, it is I think within the world of science regarded as not so different from the ultimate in any of any award. I think drawing an analogy to winning the Stanley Cup is not a bad one, for particularly for people from Cape Breton who have had past experiences with people who've done that. But it takes teamwork. And in my case, I was the, you might call it the captain of the team. And that team was extremely skilled. And so from that perspective, I'll take that analogy. But it wasn't so much starting out and attempting to win a Nobel Prize, but rather starting out with an interest in math, given to me by mainly a great teacher at Sydney Academy, Bob Chafe, and to several others. We had a class of about 30 people, and we had two PhDs in math and one in physics come out of that class as an indication of the sort of mentor we had in mathematics. And I found then that physics worked if you knew mathematics well enough, and just went on from there trying to do good science, not trying to win a prize or anything like that, but just trying to see if I could make measurements that would enable us to understand our universe a little better, and also at the same time trying to teach students as a university professor and provide some payback for the mentorship I received.
Did you know at that time that you would devote your life's work to science and research? Were you always interested in that field of study?
In high school, I really was quite uncertain what I would do as a career. I liked mathematics, I liked science, and I often get asked by kids, how do you choose a career? And I usually say, well, first of all, you better identify those things that you would like to do if you have an opportunity to when you get up in the morning to go to work, and then give some of them a try. In some cases, that would mean going to university. In other cases, it would mean apprenticeships or community college. But take an opportunity to try several of them and see which ones you're good at in addition to enjoying it. And then try to put the two together. And that's kind of the way it worked for me. I went to university and I found that I both enjoyed physics and I was also good at it. So I just kind of followed my nose from then on.
You mentioned a moment ago desire to understand the universe a little bit more and sharing that knowledge with people. One of your landmark projects involved the discovery of neutrino oscillations, which shows that neutrinos have mass. Is there a simple way you can explain that, Dr. McDonald? And is it true there's a connection with the energy created by the sun, and in turn, it could be energy very useful to us here on Earth?
Well, in terms of neutrinos and the energy produced in the sun, neutrinos are particles that penetrate through almost anything, and that makes them very difficult to detect. But if you go 2 kilometers underground, as we did, and use heavy water, which Canada has a surplus of, partly because of all the production at Joyce Bay and Port Hawkesbury, and ironically, one of my summer jobs was working at the Seaboard power plant that eventually produced the steam for the heavy water. You can detect them using heavy water, as we did, 2 kilometers underground, and thereby get a measure of the nuclear reactions that power the sun. And these are fusion reactions. They're where light nuclei come together and fuse and produce more energy than existed previously. So we studied these reactions in detail in a situation where the enormous power of the sun is confined by gravity. And there are people today who are attempting to do the same thing here on Earth, that is, to use fusion reactions to produce power. In this case, they try to hold this very hot plasma in place in a bottle where it never touches the walls, or it would melt the walls of the bottle. So it's a magnetic bottle, a way of confining these particles and turning them back into the plasma so that they'll produce the next reaction that produces the power. We've been able to show that we understand how to calculate how these reactions work in the sun with great accuracy by using these neutrinos. And that is very helpful when it comes to the people who are trying to figure out how to do it here on Earth, because they know that the mathematics that they use and the physics they use to calculate how their device would work. You know, these neutrinos are, they don't give off light themselves, but when they strike, as it happens, the deuterium in the heavy water, there are two reactions that take place, both of which give us a burst of light. And it was by comparing these two reactions that enable us to show that the type of neutrino produced in the core of the sun had turned into or oscillated into other neutrino types before they reached our detector here on Earth. And that can only happen if the neutrinos have a mass which is finite, greater than zero. And so our measurement was significant from that point of view, because that's something that was outside of the laws of physics as understood at the time. But in addition to that, by measuring these neutrinos very accurately, we could test how the sun burns. And that was the context I was mentioning in terms of how it helps with fusion power reactors here on Earth.
Have people or communities or governments expressed interest in your work or tried to learn more, you know, especially those people who are making a great effort to move away from fossil fuels and learn more about different types of energy?
Well, I think actually, you know, fusion power has been studied for a number of years, and there is a very major project happening in France, which is an international collaboration that Canada is a part of, that has been the latest stage in a series of gradually increasing and more sophisticated projects to try to make, in this case, the first demonstration that a large-scale reactor, as it's called, or power generator, based on fusion, can produce excess power compared to what you have to put into it to run it. And it's probably 10 years away from doing that, but I think we're getting closer. And there are smaller scale projects also that are happening around the world, including one from a company called General Fusion here in Vancouver that is pursuing this idea as well. So it's an active topic of technological development, and it could be very important for the future because, as you know, in Cape Breton, you can get heavy water out of the ocean in large quantities, and that would be, again, the fuel used in this case, at least the deuterium part of it.
So one day you and your colleagues, you're working, you're studying and developing this new type of energy, and Health Canada says they need your help in the fight against COVID-19, and they want you to lead an international effort. Can you take it from there, Dr. McDonald, and speak to the ventilator you and your team worked on?
Yes, well, I was, and still are, collaborating with a team in Italy, actually, that is working not on the detection of neutrinos, but the detection of dark matter particles, which have somewhat different properties, but are important in the total composition of our universe. And we use liquid argon in order to do this detection. And for that, we have a lot of work on the handling of argon gas and various processes associated with it. So my colleague, Cristiano Galbiati in Italy, contacted me early back in March of 2020, at a time when he was locked down in Milan in one of the first surges of COVID-19 in the world, and said, you know, I think our scientists and engineers have the capability of building a new type of ventilator that we could build that would be cheaper, it would be easier to produce anywhere in the world if we're very open about this, don't seek patent rights on it, which we did not. Scientists, basic scientists particularly, have a tendency to be very free and transparent like that. And so basically, it was a team of over 200 people who came together, including a group that I was able to bring together in Canada from national laboratories, the Chalk River Laboratories in Ontario, called Canadian Nuclear Laboratory. Part of the team actually in Fredericton, Triumph in laboratory in Vancouver, Snow Lab, our underground laboratory in Sudbury, and a number of academics, the part of what they have named the McDonald Institute, headquartered in Queens, but extending across the country. What we were able to do was a lot of work in the first place to design a device and then test it very thoroughly as required by Health Canada and other regulatory agencies. We were able to obtain a contract from the federal government to add to the Canadian stockpile for ventilators, and we were able to produce 7,300 of these devices by early in 2021, which are now in the Canadian stockpile and are being considered, actually, for donation to, let's say, lesser developed countries around the world who nevertheless have a great need for such ventilators as COVID has spread and is increasing greatly these days in places like Africa, for example. So what was inspiring to me is to have my colleagues and others who came together on this project and became colleagues to, well, their attitude was, you mean I can use the talents I already have to try to make a difference in this pandemic situation? Sure. I'll work hard on that. And they did, 7 days a week for a long while to get something that's really safe and reliable and being manufactured now by several Canadian manufacturers to produce that 7,300 that we built. So it's been a pretty good success story and an opportunity to make a contribution during the pandemic.
And who was it that would have used this technology? Did you get a sense of how the equipment is doing during the pandemic?
Well, it's as I say, it's in the Canadian stockpile. It was manufactured by Vexos Limited in Markham, Ontario, and JMP Solutions in London, Ontario, and we worked very closely with them. The Canadian government built up a big stockpile because it was, at the time that this was started, they were trying to cover every possibility for the degree to which COVID would sweep the country. But now, with numbers having come down, and certainly even at the peak, because Canada has a very good stockpile, then the potential use for them in other countries is what is being developed right now.
Does that mean, when you said that scientists, they don't put a lot of stock into their patents? Is this for altruistic reasons where they want their findings to be widely available and for people to learn and to benefit from it rather than self-gain or fame, for that matter?
In this case, that is really the case. There was no attempt on the part of anybody working on this project, or even the directors of the laboratories gave free rein to their scientists to work typically from home on developing these devices without any attempt to on the part of the scientists to get monetary gain for it, because of the situation where there's no doubt that that the world needs devices of this nature. And I think there was a survey done last August in Africa which said that they across Africa have one ventilator per million people or something like that. So there's no doubt of a need ultimately in the world, but at the time we started, we weren't even certain of the need in Canada. But the scientists working on it are very often doing, simply trying to provide basic information like how do neutrinos behave. And that is typically published very openly, and no attempts for patents on that sort of thing.
Did you see a lot of examples of people stepping up to the plate in your team or of any of your colleagues doing these extraordinary things under this kind of pressure, a global pressure to help people combat COVID-19?
There were many examples of it in our team here in Canada. The overall mechanical engineering lead for the project was at Chalk River in Ontario. The lead for software development, which was a very important thing. When you're trying to control something, it has to be done safely in order to meet all the requirements for treating a patient, and incorporating in the software all of the different situations you can imagine where there would be a blockage or something like that has to be compensated for. So that team was actually, they worked for Canadian Nuclear Laboratories, but they're actually based in Fredericton, and it was very valuable to us to receive their expertise in software development, because of course they're typically doing software for controlling nuclear reactors, which has to be flawless as well, and so they're very experienced in this sort of thing. And all of the people that I was dealing with, including eventually people across the country who were doing testing, as I say, worked 7 days a week for six or more months in order to meet all of the testing requirements you had to do in order to get authorization from Health Canada.
What about collaborating with some of the medical teams and what people describe as the unsung heroes, the nurses and people in the medical field on the front lines administering the vaccines and doing the testing and whatnot? What would you have to say? What would you like to say about those folks?
Oh, I have tremendous respect for people who have stepped forward in the pandemic to do that sort of job. We had, at the time that we started the project, Milan was very badly hit by COVID, and we had doctors who were dealing with COVID patients during the day, and then when they finished their day, spending time with our team advising us on what would be required in a ventilator that could help in the type of situation they were encountering. And that was extremely valuable to us because, of course, they were on the front line also of determining how does COVID affect the patient? What are the requirements for treating a patient? Because COVID was very new in March 2020. So that team was very valuable to us. And we also had tremendous assistance from government, from doctors and other people in Canada, including one particular woman who had 20 or 25 years of experience in training respiratory therapists. She was in Quebec, and she helped us tremendously in terms of what was really needed at the patient's bedside in order to do this. And I know that she was actively involved daily with treating COVID patients as well as assisting us on the side. But having her expertise, even to the point of helping us in the writing of the manual that we had to produce to go along with the device, I am really respectful of such individuals. So, I have a granddaughter actually who has been working in a long-term care home throughout the pandemic here in Ontario, and I have tremendous respect for what she has been doing as well, to bring it home, bring it to a little more personal level.
Speaking of your family, Dr. McDonald, do you have a lot of your research and your work is done in Ontario? Do you have plans to come back to Cape Breton to see your family and friends here?
I don't have very many family in Cape Breton anymore. I have a sister who lives in Dartmouth, and my parents lived in Sydney for most of their lives, but they passed away a few years ago. On the other hand, I just got an email from a friend saying, hey, as soon as we get this pandemic over, we're going to have a party. How about coming on down? And that's going to be great fun when we do that. A number of our friends getting together to have such a party, which we've done several times in the past, and it's really nice to see old friends in Cape Breton. It's a wonderful place to be from and to come back to for events like that.
Certainly some well-deserved winding down time there. Hopefully that trip will go very well for you. And I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but is there anything you'd like to add or say that I haven't asked you in this interview?
I think you've covered really most of it. I think, you know, you were asking me at the beginning this question of, you know, did I set out to win a Nobel Prize or anything like that? I think I would say to students in Cape Breton who are still in the process of either, you know, school or university or community college, there are no limitations if you pay attention, stay curious, work hard. I never expected to be in this sort of a situation, although I have to say I had tremendous support when I was in school in Cape Breton. And you can do, you know, you can even win the Stanley Cup if you work hard at that, but you can do it academically as well. Cape Breton has always had a lot of respect for education, and take advantage of that, and you can have a very wonderful career.
Thanks so much, Dr. McDonald. As usual, you're very generous with your time, and hopefully you have a great summer.
Thank you very much, and I wish the same to everyone down there. I gather things are opening up somewhat, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to get back and take advantage of that myself. Thanks a lot.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.